Welcome, patron. 90k credits have been deducted from your account. Please be advised that any thought crime offenses committed within this establishment will result in the immediate termination of your biorhythm chip. Enjoy your stay.
Good morning, class. Welcome to the inaugural episode of Hyperpodcastism. This is so what is Hyperpodcastism? Well, I'm your day class academic, your host, Borzoi Boscovich, and you might know me from a number of different shows. I'm on The Third Rail, which is a little bit more of a current events and frenetic show. You might know me from co-hosting The People's Square of Eric Stryker, which is a bit more of a political and guest-oriented show, especially on the politics side of things. Or you might know me from The Pause Button, which is very niche-oriented in its media-driven topics. So we don't often... I make a lot of references to various books. I used to be on CultureConf. We make a lot of reference to books, ideas, philosophies, all that, that don't really get time to breathe. So based on an idea that McNabb here, who's joining me today, along with Keith Woods, we thought we'd start doing a show where we get more specific into single books, single ideas, single people, and kind of really delve into the modernist, postmodern, or really just new idea. We're all about ideas here. We want to get into some real ideas. So, McNabb, you came to me with this idea, like, let's get Keith Woods on and talk about capitalist realism. So, but first, of course, my guest today, Keith Woods, Alex McNabb. How are you guys doing this morning?
Doing good.
Pretty good.
So I had to relocate my office. I'm now on the top floor of my house after all the extensive flooding. So I'm actually living through the Borzoi collapse of civilization myself in real time.
Keith and I were just talking before you came on about comparing the collapse theories of John Michael Greer's catabolic collapse versus Uckerbarty's Seneca effect.
I mean, when I say collapse, I mean in a literal sense. The highway collapsed about 2 miles from me.
Yeah, you just went off a Seneca cliff, my friend. But I guess the way to kick this off would be first, like I said, we're talking about capitalist realism, which was a essay book, really more of an essay written by. Published in 2009 by Mark Fisher, who was a British writer, cultural critic. I believe you could properly call him a Marxist, and if you want to assign an ideology to him. Although when you read capitalist realism, you begin to see kind of the limits of ideology, and it's one of the problems that, from what I've read, is probably one of the best ways of explaining and seeing how what it's like to live through a postmodern reality. But what was it that spurred you to want to at least have a talk about it? Like, this spun off into making a whole show out of it, but you wanted to have a talk with me and Keith about this, Alex. So what spurred all that on?
Well, I was familiar with capitalist realism. I think I read it the first time like last year or the year before. I just kind of thinking about how capitalist realism structures the way that we think about possibilities. I mean, I think that the term is pretty salient and it does describe our current situation. And the idea that he's talking about is not necessarily that you can't imagine an alternative capitalism. It's just easier to imagine the world actually coming to an end, collapsing, apocalypse, all of that. It's easier to imagine everything in.
And Keith, you, because like when I approached you with this, I wasn't sure if you had read or not. You had indicated that you had already read Capitalist Realism in the past. What was your previous experience with the work, and did you have any initial thoughts when you first read the work?
Well, it's interesting. Capitalist Realism has become kind of a starting point for the modern left. I mean, for a book that's not even 100 pages, it's kind of amazing the impact it's had. You see it discussed a lot in our circles as well, and there's a lot of quotable passages and ideas that Fisher introduced. I'd say for anyone, if they want like a very comprehensive but also accessible introduction to sort of modern Marxist ideas, that yeah, they should touch Fisher's Capitalist Realism. It's not overly academic either, but it introduces some. It's a very good starting point to sort of jump off into. You can go more in depth off it because it has a a wealth of suggestion, I'd say, in terms of anti-capitalist ideas.
And what I found to be very prescient about this is that the work was published in 2009, right when the financial, right in the midst, especially for Alex and I, because he and I were millennials. So he and I at that time period were definitely had come of age into this uncertain and strange new time period. We had a new president. He was black, and that was supposed to change things. And I remember they were talking at that time, like, oh, he's going to be the next FDR, and we're going to rein in these banks. And not only did nothing come of that, it got worse, and it got worse in ways that most people couldn't quite grasp or comprehend how and why that was happening. And all of this, of course, prefigures what some people call the 2011 Great Awakening, where you start to see this aggressive push towards what would be termed identity politics. But we know that's a little bit more of a oversimplification of it. But you see this new form of leftism, this co-opted, bought-in leftism. And for a movement that had kind of, especially in the United States, was struggling with an identity after the 1999 WTO protests, and then going into the wilderness in the Bush years, to come out while the Democrats were positioned in the after the election of Obama, and then what was going on in the financial industry, it fundamentally transformed everything to where we are now. And Fisher was very prescient on this point. He was very wise to connect this with postmodernism, but he did something I found very interesting. He chose to call it capitalist realism. And he wanted to move away from the term postmodernism, which I think was a bit smart, because I don't have an issue with it, but that is a word that it's a very loaded word, and it can be a problematic word when you're talking about the things he's talking about in capitalist realism, which the term capitalist realism probably drives home better the reality of the situation. I don't know what thoughts you guys have on that.
I know that he equates capitalist realism with postmodernism, but I feel like Fisher's work and some of the works that have come out just in the last few years, like John David Ebert has done a lot of work on this. I feel like they're actually identifying kind of a break with postmodernism. I think you could say that Fisher is what he's describing is hypermodernism, as a lot of people describe it now. Again, that'd be Ebert's term for it. But there is a clear break, it seems, with conventional sort of postmodern accounts of Marxist accounts of capitalism. I think it has a lot to do with the growth of the internet. It's like the interior of modernism was the arcade, then the interior of postmodernism was the shopping mall. And you can see that reflected in some of the sort of Marxist accounts of postmodernism. But the interior of the world that Mark Fisher is describing is the internet. And, the effects of the internet have sort of revolutionized capitalism in such a way that I think we can now talk about kind of a new epoch brought in by the internet that is distinct enough from postmodernism that it can be sort of analyzed on its own terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said something interesting to me before we started the show, Keith, about how you used to read in a year over 100 books, and now, thanks to the internet, it's pretty much destroyed your ability to read a book. And I know for part of, like, a big reason that I'm going to guess is probably social media, but this keys into something that I've talked about before, but that many thinkers have talked about before, is that technology and media and that intersection, it shapes us more than we shape it, and it affects behavior in subtle but very important ways. And it can, what we've seen with people's perception of reality and the way that they engage that reality, you can see such a fundamental shift between that time period, which is why this book kind of ends up being a really important keystone moment in the timeline of when it was published. Because access, just to finish, because I know you want to jump in here, Alex, because access to technology also ramped up during this time period. The access to the internet, that fundamentally changed everything. And you and I talked before, Alex, about how for when we were younger, the amount of legwork we had to do just to engage with computers compared to what's available now and how that's affect people's intelligence. But go ahead, you wanted to say something.
Yeah. Mark Fisher actually talks about this explicitly, and what he refers to is this phenomena of time being broken in these micro slices. Like, there's a great quote here about what we in the classroom are now facing as a generation born into a historical anti-monomic blip culture, a generation, that is to say, for whom time has always come ready cut into digital micro slices. And he talks about how Jameson observed the breakdown of temporality suddenly releases the present time from all the activities and intentionalities that might focus it and make it a space of praxis. So one of the points he's kind of getting to here is essentially destroying our sense of temporality prevents us from actually taking any kind of collective action against the system. And you can kind of see this in people's attention spans now. Like, it's impossible for people to focus on things. And if you're not completely subsumed by this, you'll be kind of mystified by what you see before you. Like, wow, I just saw this same lying news headline like 2 months ago. Why are they doing this again? Why are they doing this obvious propaganda that I've already seen before? Like, did people forget about this? How do people forget that they're being lied to right now?
And you can also see it in the way that they are trying to fundamentally change even older forms of media themselves, because this micro slice, that phenomenon you're talking about, and this is very much aided by the shaping effects of technology. I remember this might have just died on the vine and nothing may have come of it. I have trouble keeping up with what's going on in the culture these days, but I remember a few years ago, I think Dean Koontz was really heavily involved in this. They had this idea of creating what they called book shots, which was an even more micro form of literature that you could buy. Like, say, I think it was designed especially for people who were supposed to be going on public transportation and didn't have a book to read, but this was supposed to be a book you could read in a very short span of time. So this of course meant that the literature had to be oriented much more towards this shot form of being able to ingest the content of literature in a much more simpler and much more quicker function, almost like that in the old cartoons where you have like the futuristic society. Instead of eating the meal, you have that pill that makes you full. Like, it's supposed to be this delivery mechanism that makes your life more convenient. But of course, that's never really what it is. Like, that pill could never really give you the nutrition and the feeling of eating that you need as a human being, you know, shaped in your biology to function. Much the same way that literacy and literature was evolved, you can't like condense that to a book shot form and still have it function the same way, but it does train you to be in this micro sliced way of life. And I think it probably leads to a much more shattered sense of identity, or at least a lot more nervous disorders are going to come out of that kind of way you're structuring your life.
Yeah, because you can't actually tell a narrative about your own life. You don't have the that sort of looking all the way back across the span of your history anymore. All you have are these little slices of time, these little Instagram photos, these little short videos. So it's hard to connect events over your entire lifespan together into something coherent.
And that actually connects to something that he talks about at the start of this work, which this is something I've noticed before, like in terms of the media environment we're saturated in, is what this level of capitalism does is it puts you into a realm of complete no context. He cites the example of Children of Men, the film, where you have these fragments of culture that are no longer relevant because there's no longer a younger generation to pass them down onto. So these things become very emblematic of a culture that's just being preserved, and it's a culture of no culture at all. Quoting from here, the fate of Picasso's Guernica in the film, once a howl of anguish and outrage against fascist atrocities, now a wall hanging, is exemplary. Like its Battersea hanging space in the film, the painting is accorded iconic status only when it is deprived of any possible function or context. No cultural object can retain its power when there are no longer new eyes to see it. And this is a very important point, especially in the sense of media, because under neoliberalism, under this neoliberal capitalism, things are only ascribed special meaning when they arrive at contextlessness. Because capitalism is intrinsically linked to media. Because like, think about it, like the two other positions, fascism and communism, they were so nascent with the televised image, and even no matter how much they did with that, 99% of all transmitted media throughout our brief history of this has been through the capitalist frame. It has owned that totally and completely. And so it's created this ever-present field of no context. Is what there was a New Yorker writer named George W.S. Trow. He wrote a book about this called Within the Context of No Context. And that's what he was astounded by with the rise of television culture, is that people lived completely contextless lives that were being informed by these visceral images that they couldn't put into a cohesive narrative anymore into their lives. I mean, like, you take, because like before people had images, like you go to the church, you see the, especially if you were an illiterate, you go to the church, you see the stained glass windows, and these are designed in specific ways that there's a narrative here, and you have this connection to a religious community, and you have an entire narrative that forms out of that. It's a humble narrative, but it's a narrative that you can base your life on, and you have those images that reify that. You don't have that anymore in a televised media culture. You have these out of context visceral images that have tremendous effects on you, but you can't put a story to that, that from birth to death, that makes much sense.
Yeah. The way it sort of takes images and artifacts of history and just turns them into fetishes. It's pretty interesting. It's a divorce from context, from kind of meaning. It's just your effective reaction to it. Like the way that you feel about the image that's important. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you had any.
I think the best example of that is, like, you know, I wasn't alive in the 60s, 70s, or 80s, but I know what if someone asks you what the sound of the 60s is in terms of the, you know, the music, the culture of the time, you know instantly. It's the same thing about the 70s, same thing about the 80s. But I mean, you know, we just finished a decade of the 2010s. And it's like, what was the sound of the 2010s? Like, what was the music of the 2010s?
Yes,
like, exactly. I couldn't answer that. I don't think I could even name, like, I remember looking at the charts like last year, and it was like, you know, of the 100 people, I think I knew like two or three names. So it's a weird thing. Like, music itself has just become this kind of pure commodity. Like, he talks about Kurt Cobain, and like Kurt Cobain faced this challenge of, like, you know, he was trying to kind of rebel against the system, but anything he did was just necessarily commodified to the point that they could, you know, they could predict what he was going to do. And then even his suicide became commodified in this weird way. And it's like, music now is like, you don't even have an artist like Kurt Cobain. There's not even the real there that's then sort of transformed into the hyper real by the commodification process. It's just the hyper real from start to finish. Like, we don't have a Kurt Cobain now. I mean, I remember the time Soleimani in Iran was killed, and there was a funny clip going around of the Iranian guy calling into TV stations saying, you know, if you wanted to kill an American hero, who would you kill? SpongeBob. So there's no larger than life figure. And it's like, the, you know, the celebrity of the 90s was Kurt Cobain, but what do we have now? We have the E-celeb. And like, the E-celeb is someone that's just pure commodity. Like, the, you know, the kind of person that, like, you know, people sit watching and playing video games for 12 hours and give them donations, you know, like these people like Brittany Venti and these people. It's like, they're just pure commodity. Even like someone like the Kardashians, like, they're not really famous for anything other than that they're, you know, they're an ideal commodity. They're so easily commodified, and that's turned into an ideal, and then they're famous just for that sort of potential to be famous. So it's a very weird thing. But yeah, even the real that the hyperreal used to be derived from, like, you know, the talent of someone like Kurt Cobain, even that isn't necessary anymore. It is just the signifiers. It is just the hyperreal aspect.
And I'll answer your question here, Keith. Like, what's the music of this past decade of the 20-teens that we just went through? Somebody I saw in the chat mentioned mumble rap. That can actually play into the answer I was going to give, because it was very again, there was a synchronicity to this past decade that we just lived through. One of the early films within this past decade I came out in 2011 was Drive. And the Drive soundtrack was more significant than the film itself. The two songs in particular, but I would say especially the one, Kavinsky's Night Call, ushered in this huge revival of synthwave, which was just continuing certain themes and motifs and musical ideas that were percolating in the 1980s that had been somewhat popular in the 1980s. And then synthwave, I think in congruence with that, you had Vaporwave. Now, Vaporwave was more of a fad, but because it was such a weird form of music, and it was for a brief time, everyone was into Vaporwave for 1 year, and maybe not even a full year, but for 1 year, everybody was really into Vaporwave, and there was something about it that people were drawn to on a philosophical level, and they attempted to explain it and make sense of it. And all these two things signify is how what happens when culture goes into this complete contextlessness, when there's nothing like it, this is how far afield you've gone, because now there's nothing to create. Now they can only go backwards and cannibalize the past, and begins to go into these various like irony. And this is, it's not for nothing that the culture turned extremely ironic in this decade as well, because there was nowhere else to go except inward and to cannibalize that, and to commodify that, and then to go deeper layer upon layer until everything is lost. There's no room for sincerity anymore. And every attempt to even make, to be sincere, and there were a lot of attempts to be sincere in that decade, just gets cannibalized back into that same process. It became this horrific feedback loop that just did not stop. And it just, 2019 might've been the most ironic year we've had yet.
Yeah, I think that ties into Derrida's idea of hauntology, that the present is oversaturated with images and ideas from the past. And what I personally think is that a lot of this has to do with the structure of capitalism and empiricism itself as a science. It's always backwards facing. You have to take like product A, look at how it does in the market, and then you make product B that's going to be like a variation on product A, but it won't be anything fundamentally new. It'll just be very slightly adjusted. And that's the sort of world we live in now. We don't have space for any kind of true creativity, and no one wants to take a chance on actually being creative. See this with film, for example. I mean, how many comic book movies have we had now? How many times have we rebooted Batman? We can't escape Batman.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because Marvel, in terms of the comic book movie, Marvel is the king champion of that, and everyone complains, like, you know, like it's been put into this position where it's situated, where it's like it can't, it's just this juggernaut that can't be stopped, because it's just got that lowest common denominator appeal that functions in a global economy and the attempt to make a global culture, to water it down to these very basic image levels. And so that's not going away anytime soon, but of course there has to be something, like, much like, you know, it's funny, we were talking about how you have the slight variation, like you see this in politics as well, you see this in democracy, you can't have any true creativity, you can only have the slight variation. But the way that these things are constructed is you're supposed to build your identity around it and not see it for the thing that it is, and not see it for the commodity or the narrative messaging you're supposed to internalize. You don't see it for that. So I had a funny thought this morning that occurred to me. It was just because, like, I was looking at a lot of people who are deep into being ironic on Twitter, the amount of them that have the recent Joker movie as their Abby, the complete the way that they embraced Joaquin Phoenix in this darker telling of the Joker story. It occurred to me, like, well, everyone talks about how much they hate Marvel movies, but it's just the people who are talking about that are just DC fans. When you think about it, that's all it is. Like, they've just embraced DC. They've embraced a variation of DC comics, but they just embraced the competitor.
Yeah, well, that reminds me of another little point that Fisher was making about Office Space. And one of the scenes in Office Space involves somebody who's wearing flair, They have to have personal flair, which is like seven, I don't know, little quirky things, little pins or emblems you'd put on your uniform. And I think that's actually how politics works for most people these days that think that they're somehow unique or edgy, is they use ideas like anarchism as flair. It's just personal flair. I put this on my shirt and it makes me slightly different, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been thinking about that as well. That's one thing that kind of fascinates me, actually, is seeing the seeing this generation of like 18, 19 year olds that are adopting traditional Catholicism and like being an ironic tradcath on Twitter. There's this weird intersection between like religion, politics, technology, and you just get this monster out of it. It's like there was a great screenshot of someone was posting on Reddit like I want to convert to Catholicism because I like the aesthetics and it's really base. Like, can someone explain the theology to me? It's like it's this weird thing where like, but it's all about the aesthetics, and in this weird way, it's like I mean, what we're talking about with capitalist realism and this attempt at identity formation on the internet is that, you know, as capitalism sort of runs out of spaces to commodify, all that's really left is identity. And, you know, it stands to reason that in late capitalism that this urge to consume is going to be turned into identity formation, and that, you know, the internet actually serves as kind of the perfect avenue for that in late capitalism, because it's so flexible, because it's so rapid. You know, it's the ideal space to allow this sort of commodification of identity. But yeah, what you get is this weird kind of hyper-modern splicing of identities that precisely, you know, something like traditional Catholicism, precisely because it's removed from the context in which it had meaning to people, it just becomes, yeah, it becomes meaningless. It's another internet identity.
Yeah, and what's weird, just on that point of trade Catholicism, what's weird about that is it becomes easier for people to say, to get into arguments on minor points of theology with Protestants and Orthodox from a Catholic perspective than it is for them to say that the Nicene Creed, to say that I believe in Jesus Christ, that he's my savior, and have them say that sincerely. People get into the theological argumentative aspects of it and struggle with the actual belief itself, which is a very strange phenomenon. What were you going to say, Alex?
Oh, well, you know that they spawn in game as that character, so then they have to fight the other character who spawned in game as well. But yeah, no, there's a great quote though where Fisher talks about how alternative and independent don't designate something outside mainstream culture. Rather, they are styles. In fact, the dominant styles within the mainstream. So it's like this idea that yet again it's been subsumed by the capitalist realist culture itself. It's just another little variation, another little piece of flair you put on your uniform. But at heart, it doesn't designate anything that's a true alternative, or truly independent from what you see before you.
Yeah,
I think the new age religions are a good example of that as well, or like the phenomenon of the new age, because it's again, it's all this sort of hyper-real extraction, and it's always some kind of commodity. And at the same time, you see like some of the tropes of new age get kind of used by the corporate world, you know, like they'll have like seminars on mindfulness. You know, Google will bring a speaker to lecture on mindfulness in the workplace, and they'll be teaching their employees, you know, techniques for positive thinking. So like, that's like the ultimate bastardization, is like Buddhism and yoga in the modern corporate workplace.
Yeah, they've commodified it. They turned it into a product. They divorced it of its context and lifted it out of the original culture and just inserted it into capitalism.
Yeah, and see if I can get this thing's going to go to my... Here we go. So, yeah, in capitalist realism, he mentions Deleuze and Guattari, a quote from here, in their account of capitalism, surely the most impressive since Marx's, Deleuze and Guattari described capitalism as a kind of dark potentiality which haunted all previous social systems. Capital, they argue, is the unnameable thing, the abomination which primitive and feudal societies warded off in advance. When it actually arrives, capitalism brings with it a massive desacralization of culture. And something that occurred to me, and this goes along with what you guys are talking about here, is you have Heidegger in his analysis of technology noted that under a technological society, what ends up happening, and this is especially true in a capitalist society because so much it's out of everything begins to become a numerical value, and then with the effect of technology, you're able to maximize the yield that you get out of that number, so that the thing itself is no longer the thing. It's just a yield number. To give an example, like you take a look at a piece of land. To a farmer, that's the thing that I plant stuff in, and has to be tended to a certain way to make the crops grow. And sometimes you need a little bit of help from the gods to make it happen. But this is like there's a much more holistic and rooted sense of farming when it's just that. But then when you begin to implement machines to better improve that farming, and then as it gets, you move towards a more digital society, now that land is not just land, that thing has a digital yield, it has a numerical yield, and you can begin to maximize it as much as possible to pump that number up. And so you see this under capitalism with this unnameable thing, is that everything becomes a commodity, everything becomes a resource and has an extraction value, and becomes this in literally life itself. Just like that scene in Wolf of Wall Street, these are rookie numbers, you got to pump those up. And because that's such an unnatural effect on human beings, they have to start engaging with these other ways of basically keeping people from having the disastrous effects when you adapt too much to this way of thinking. When you begin to see everything, like it's what makes people, I think it's what makes people so autistic, like not in the traditional, not in the proper clinical sense of the word of being a neurotypical, but in the fact that everything in your life is just numbers. Everything in your life is how do I pump the resource value up? And you actually see this gamification in your life where it begins to move towards that. They look for ways to basically counter that and kind of keep you from going too far off the deep end on that, because that could have disastrous effects and could make you worse of an employee if you keep thinking of life completely in that way. They always worry about burnout, but they commodify you basically.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the other larger overall points that Fisher was making about capitalist realism itself, is that it actually requires a lot of effort to sustain the idea that this is somehow a workable system, and that it's somehow compatible with people when it's clearly not, and it makes everyone go insane after a certain amount of time, and it causes mental illness, is like one of the major causes of mental illness. But we have to kind of ignore that and never point the finger at the system itself. It's always like the problem is with the individual somehow, or the individual's neurochemistry.
But then what do they do with mental illness? They commodify that itself, mm-hmm. and then they turn that into an identity that you want to embrace, and then they attach certain specialness to this that people begin to want to induce mental illness or to believe that they are mentally ill in order to get the resources or value or the status they believe that they are afforded, or at least, or a reification of their own, of these narratives that they've begun to internalize, or these out of context images that have begun to deeply affect their lives.
Actually, the best example would be obesity. So we've taken that and turned it into something you're supposed to be proud of, right? Being obese. But that's an artificial body created by this mass consumer corporate capitalist system. Like, it's not normal, it's an artifact of the way that this thing breaks people, but you're supposed to actually venerate that now. I mean, it's really quite amazing how that works. It's probably the most fascinating way I've ever seen to run cover for something monstrous like McDonald's Corporation.
what's been the scariest thing for many of us when we got out of this conservative mindset? Like, and for many people, being conservative was just a way of like not being ashamed of being white. That's a fact, and not wanting to have your money go to minorities. I mean, that is in effect what made people conservative. But when we get out of that and we begin to try and analyze this from a systemic level, and you begin to see the way that people, because now they're bought into this, like now I'm a conservative, now I'm a Republican, now I'm supposed to believe certain things, and they get bought in on this completely, and they begin to now affect this as their identity. Like, people on the forum were talking about how astounded they were at the idea that people need to be working to the bone in order to and to avoid getting help whatsoever, because they're completely bought into this idea of how capitalism is supposed to work, and that it's objectively a good thing because any possible alternative would have to be disastrous Venezuelan socialism.
Yeah, that's the deflationary aspect that Fisher talks about. I see this all the time when people argue about capitalism versus communism or any other system. It's, well, you know, it's better than the alternative. You know, it's slightly better than starving to death in a work camp somewhere. And I'm like, how is that actually a good argument for your system? All you're doing is pointing to other systems and making a claim that they're somehow worse.
And since the fall of the Soviet Union, the only other systems have just been these outdated, hanger-on countries that are just trying to, and they're only getting along because of inertia at this point. It's just, we live in a global financial neoliberal capitalist system. There is next to no alternatives. Like, this is the totality of the world we live in now.
Well, I mean, that's the thing as well, is like, if you advocate for a third position or some kind of national socialism, that, there's a constant tendency for people to think that you're advocating communism in the way you speak. And then there's a constant tendency to like equate that with the Soviet Union. And you might think that that's, you could say that that's kind of Cold War thinking, and that people think in this very binary way of capitalism versus communism. That is to an extent, but it is also a reflection of capitalist realism, in that they're not able to think outside of capitalism, because even the Soviet Union was subject to the logic of capital. You know, the Soviet Union was expanding at a rate comparable to the US, and it was reliant on constant industrialization and use of fossil fuels and so on. And so, the logic of capital was still there in the Soviet Union. It was just incredibly authoritarian and state managed. But if when people can only conceive of some kind of ostensibly communist but state capitalist society like China or the USSR versus the more decentralized capitalism of the West, that is capitalist realism. Like, we've given up on theorizing what a post-capitalism could look like, and that very binary approach of communism and capitalism that the left and the right reify is actually a reification of capitalist logic.
Yeah.
As Fisher opens it up, and this is what piqued my interest when McNabb sold me on this, is that it's easier to imagine the end of the world and what that would look like and all of its effects than it has ever been to imagine the end of capitalism.
I mean, capitalism sells us movies about the end of the world. It doesn't really sell us anything about the end of capitalism.
Yeah. It's almost impossible to imagine. That's just like the way it's just, and that, like, that's where you get some of these reactions from some people. It's like, it's difficult to imagine. This is a point I bring up a lot, and it's just because it's something that I find very, very fascinating. There was a French historian / philosopher. I forget what he was, academic. There was a French academic named because I always get him mixed up with a known theologian. His name was Lucia, I believe was his name. He wrote a work called Unbelief in 16th century France, or Unbelief in the time of Rabelais in France. He did a whole book on unbelief, and way he constructed what did it mean to be an unbeliever in 16th century France. And the way he went about this was he went through everything that was written down during that time period to construct the picture of what it was like for the average person at that time to be living a day-to-day normal life. And the kind of thoughts that, because of the way you're engaging your environment, what kind of thoughts would enter into your head and what would have you been able to comprehend and understand. And using everything from just like the way people took noted time to grocery list to all that stuff, he was able to construct that it was impossible to conceive of yourself as an atheist in 16th century France. An atheist as we would understand today, like that there's just that there are no deities, there's no God, there's, you know, not having a belief in any kind of higher power. He concluded it was impossible to even be able to conceive of that, because in 16th century France, your entire life, from the moment you were born and from all the people you were interacted with on a day-to-day life and the way that society was structured, was so suffused in religious imagery, religious language, and religious talk, and just reflexively religious talk, that it was just, there had to be something, and yet you acted as if, like, you just, like, the thought just wouldn't have occurred to somebody to think that there could be no God. It just, that was your ever-present life. It was impossible to conceive of a world, of a reality without God, without angels, without these higher powers. And that's, like, you see much the same thing with how much we're in the same situation with capitalism. It is impossible for us to conceive of a world without capitalism, because it informs our every waking moment with the way that it directs our livelihoods, our technology, our culture, and our images, and even the way we speak and conceive of money and transaction.
Yeah, it's like the business ontology at this point, and this idea that every problem has to be solved through some sort of capitalistic process. Like that's how we fix problems, right? We subcontract it. We use a competitive process to arrive at what is the supposedly the most efficient way of handling the situation.
I mean, look at some of the reactions to the coronavirus lockdown. Like there's people here, like, you know, it's easier to imagine the end of the world and the end of capitalism. Like, it's easier to imagine a cabal of lizard people using Bill Gates as their proxy to sterilize the world and give everyone brain cancer with 5G than it is to imagine a change in capitalism. It's like there's people here in Ireland that were, like, seemingly kind of saying national populist last year, whatever, and now it's like they're doing, like, the Bill Gates, like, really kind of wacky stuff. I'm not saying all skepticism to the lockdown is bad or whatever, but they're doing, like, the real wacky stuff, like David Icke, Bill Gates, all that stuff. And at the same time, what they're advocating for then in terms of a real policy is, like, well, we have to go back because the GDP has gone down this much, and by this quarter, the economy will have shrunk this much. And regardless of how out there their interpretation of things are, what they end up advocating for is we need to get back to work, get the GDP back on track. Everyone needs to get back working for their corporation. You know, we need to fix the deficit. And it just becomes, yeah, it becomes totally reinforcing of the system. The people with the most extreme out there conspiratorial language just end up advocating for the status quo.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's a go ahead, McNam.
That reminds me of a great turn of phrase that Mark Fisher uses, where he talks about market Stalinism. Like, we have to get these numbers moving. We have got to get these numbers, these abstractions. They're not lining up to where they're supposed to be. We got to
those are
something.
Rookie numbers, son. You got to pump them up.
And it's like, well, what do these numbers even refer to? Well, who knows?
Yeah, it turns everything into. Did you guys ever, like, see those or play those idle clicker games? It just turns, like, everything just becomes, like, you have an entire society of basically cookie clicker. Like, we've become the cookie clicker society. It's like, why am I increasing the number of cookies? Why am I constantly buying all these, like, these additions and upgrades that make the cookie clicker do the cookie clicking automatically for me, that increases the amount of cookies? Like, I don't know where I'm going with all these cookies. Now, it's kind of cute that I have all these grandmas now that are baking cookies faster than I could ever bake them, but why do I have 6 trillion cookies now? What am I doing with my life? Why have I spent the last 4 hours clicking on the screen? Like, what is wrong with me? I've done this a couple times. I get sucked into the cookie clicker thing.
I'm not even familiar with cookie clicker. I've never
heard of the cookie. Idle games are one of the weirdest. Like, idle only under capitalist realism could a idle clicker game be called a game and be a real thing. And unfortunately, as I always say, you are not immune to propaganda. I'm certainly not immune myself.
I mean, what it comes down to is how people conceive of happiness and the good life. And regardless of what people will say, and you know, they'll give you plenty of bullshit and platitudes. For 99.9% of people, happiness now is equated with an open space of freedom of choice, which normally means within this sort of consumption matrix. And you know, that's the unquestioned assumption of the age, and that's what props up this logic of keeping the big line going up. You know,
well, what something you said, Keith, that because I don't want to move away from this lockdown just yet. Something that you said that made me think of something is we had these protests, and one thing we tended to notice when we first got into racial politics was that once you stepped outside of what was the expected frame, when you were thinking for yourself or looking or approaching things from a different angle, liberals would often not know what to say to you, and they'd almost shut down because they were used to the dialectic of like, well, a conservative says this to me, so I say this back to them. Like everything becomes these predicted responses. Well, now, like, I think under the system, people internalize the idea that they're supposed to be a cog in a machine. And that's a very troubling thing, because like, think about all these protests against the lockdown. Like, if you were to give these people complete power and tell them, like, all right, you're not only are you ending the lockdown, you're in charge now. I don't think they'd know what to do. All they wanted was things to be opened back up because they wanted a sense of normalcy. But I don't think they'd be able to define what normalcy is or what a healthy normalcy should be. But the idea of things being different, of this disruption in capitalism, and I understand that there were people who were hurt by this because, like, especially the small business angle, I'm not talking about that specifically. What I'm talking about is people not knowing what to do with a disruption. That's like you are, like, they have internalized this idea, like, I am just a powerless cog at best. And that's, I don't think most people are cognizant that we are trained to internalize that messaging.
Yeah, well, I mean, we would talk about how it's easier to imagine the end of civilization and capitalism. Well, for these people, it's easier to imagine the end of their own lives, too. Like, you give them the choice of contracting SARS and potentially dying a horrible, suffocating death versus not being able to go to Applebee's. And be like, oh, you know, I'll take the chance. I'll go to Applebee's.
You know, we had the peculiar phenomenon of, you were talking about this, McNabb, of with restaurants trying to open up, and they're trying to do the social distancing thing where you walk in with the mask, then you can go to a table that's separated a little bit further from other tables, so then you can take off the mask to eat, and you're only supposed to be wearing the mask a short distance. Well, there was an example, a friend of mine, they had a cafe that tried to open up in her town, couldn't, like, they had to shut it back down because people would not comply with the simple request that just wear the mask a short distance. And like but the thing is, like, when I think about both scenarios, the idea of just wearing the mask a short distance to go take it off, but also the idea of not just being able to comply with the simple request that the restaurant has to legally follow in order to stay open, both of these are such absurd situations. It is no wonder that I think that people are starting to go a little bit bonkers from this whole thing, because it's really just kind of thrown everybody for a loop, and things, it's just really exposed a lot of the absurdities and contradictions that's inherent in the way that these things are structured.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. It's like, why do we have to preserve the restaurant structure if everybody has to go here and eat? Like, that's not a natural thing. People used to eat it in their own homes, used to have dinner together. Like, why are we always having to go to a restaurant? And yeah, you're talking about how people can't modify their behavior. If you going to Walmart during this whole crisis has been mind-blowing, because people can't follow some very simple directions on a floor, like arrows, like go down the line this way or do this thing. They can't figure out that if you're going to wear a mask, and by the way, I don't recommend masks, I recommend respirators, but if you're going to wear a mask, it needs to be over your nose, and they can't figure that out either. And they have this whole information world at their fingertips that none of them can navigate correctly to actually learn what they should do. And I guess there's a point there too about how the information age has turned out to be the biggest lie in human history. That's led to more disinformation and more outright propaganda than anything.
As Keith noted, you go from reading 100 books a year to reading 3.
Yeah. Oh no, I feel it.
Fisher actually talks about that early in the book as well, that you know, that he has students that complain about reading Nietzsche because he's difficult, and you know, he makes the point that, you know, the point of Nietzsche is that he's difficult, and that, you know, those kinds of that kind of approach to things is being lost now, and we're losing an aspect of knowledge and philosophy that's important. And you know, in the place of that kind of rigorous intellectual work, what you get is the, you know, the 5-minute Jordan Peterson video, or the clip from the Joe Rogan podcast. I mean, probably the best example of it is these science popularizers like Neil deGrasse Tyson and Bill Nye, and even the, you know, actual accomplished scientists that have got into this. Like, I often talk about this. Stephen Hawking wrote a book called, I think it was called The Grand Design, where he talked about the origin of the universe and presented it as a work of science, but really it was a work of speculative philosophy and cosmology. And I mean, most of the things that he was speculating about were, it was more, I mean, there was no more reason to assert the things he was asserting than there was to make a case for a personal theistic god of Christianity. It was, you know, there was far more assumptions in the arguments he was making. But these books got really popular in the 2000s. And even though we talk about how saturated and irony everything is in hypermodernity, there is definitely a yearning for a new meta-narrative. And so that was filled by those science popularizers, because again, they have that sort of matter and the void worldview that lines up well with the age and with capitalism. And it's interesting that someone like Peterson became popular then, because the, you know, the intellectual of technological society is, I think we talked about this before, Borzoi, is the specialist or the scientist.
Yes.
But Peterson is kind of a rejection of that, because, you know, in the 19th century, you had these great systematizers. You had people like Spengler or Schopenhauer, Leibniz before that, people that knew a bit about everything, you know, real Renaissance men that would create these great projects of systematizing the world, like Spengler's work. And that hasn't been a thing, you know. That was Lyotard's definition of postmodernism, was that it was a rejection of the meta-narrative following World War II. And that's how it's basically been since the Second World War. But despite that, there is a new yearning to go back to a meta-narrative. And in a way, what we're talking about with all this commodification and pointless consumption is coming from probably a healthy desire for people to find, even if they don't know they're looking for it, is to find that kind of meta-narrative. And Jordan Peterson got popular precisely because he was a throwback to that kind of 19th century approach of being a bit of a Renaissance man that knows a bit about everything and sort of splicing all these things together. Not the biggest fan of Peterson, but it shows there is a yearning there. And the internet allowed someone like him to become popular over the, you know, the crap that someone like Bill Nye or Stephen Hawking puts out that was filling that role during the atheism Christianity disputes. But it is interesting. People are going back to this search for like a kind of metaphysical understanding of things.
I'm really glad you brought this up, Keith. Yeah. Go ahead.
Good jumping off point.
Yeah. Well, okay. Just let me, like, because like I have something I think that will build on that right there, because Keith mentions the issue that students are having with Nietzsche, and he mentions the rise of like this popular science. Now, what was coupled with that? Keith mentioned it. You had this attack on religion, but specifically Christianity. What in like all these things? What do you notice in all of this? Is that what you have is that capitalism encourage this capitalist realism actually does encourage you to become a type of critic, because you become a critic of other people's identities or other people's commodities. But why do these students struggle with Nietzsche? It's because this, and this is something that Nietzsche talked about, and as well as Kierkegaard, was the problem of resentment, the philosophical idea of resentment. And we live in an age of resentment. So you are encouraged to be a critic, but do you know what you're not encouraged to be, or you're incapable of being? Reflective. We do not live in a reflective age. And I believe we're engineered to be incapable of that and to be increasingly more incapable of that. You can be the critic, you can be a critic till the cows come home, but when is the last time you've heard something that was truly reflective, something that was truly soul-searching? And you see this problem in religion itself as well, where you adopt religion as identity, but you have lost the ability to have even the spiritual and metaphysical reflection, because like that involves a certain level of prostration and humbleness and the ability to see yourself as like for, you know,
yeah, the only soul for searching.
What you are. McNabb, please. Yeah.
The only soul search.
Yeah, the all search. The all search. The all search.
Yeah, it's like a very commodified, socially moderated form of soul searching, where it's like, and then I realized that I was racist and I need to work on that. Like, that's basically as far as it goes. But yeah, no, this is a very good angle here, because there were a few quotes I thought were pretty interesting. Fisher talks about some stuff Zizek said, but first of all, the attitude of ironic distance proper to postmodern capitalism is supposed to immunize us against the seductions of fanaticism. Because you see this sort of hostility towards meta-narratives, a hostility towards ideology. And then he quotes Zizek, who says, in today's society you must appear post-ideological. The prevailing ideology is that of cynicism. People no longer believe in ideological truth. They do not take ideological propositions seriously. And an ideological position can never be really successful until it is naturalized, and it cannot be naturalized but still thought of as a value rather than a fact. Accordingly, neoliberalism has sought to eliminate the very category of value in the ethical sense. And I think that's very important. The idea of meta-ethical propositions and of value in that ethical sense has been annihilated. It's been destroyed, and it was done on purpose. And one of the things that we would have to actually do is transcend that and say, no, this is actually fact. Like, you need to believe in this, because this is true. It's going to impact your life. It's not just a piece of flair you're going to stick on your uniform here. Like, this is actually something that goes beyond that. There is a deeper meaning here.
And part of that problem lies at, because capitalism goes hand in hand with liberalism. So, and then because of the threat it received from the second and third positions of communism and fascism, liberalism, because of the inherent weaknesses that thinkers like Carl Schmitt accurately identified, it had to evolve into the neoliberal position in order to gain that strength and anti-fragility and to accelerate that capitalism so that it couldn't be sundered by any other type of economic system, ideology, or way of being. So what you end up seeing is, well, if that, like, since that's rooted right in liberalism, the problem with liberalism is it is that thing. It is that unknowable but always expanding, always intrusive and subversive thing that has to, because it has no sense of itself, and because it has such a weak friend enemy distinction, it means it has no inherent, like, it does not have an intrinsic belief system that's going to be strong enough to be able to stand against anything that's more cohesive. So by nature, it has to expand across the entire globe in order to protect itself. And then once it has conquered the world, it is free to do as it pleases, as it drains the meaning and distinctions out of everything in order to prevent an internal collapse from occurring.
Yeah, and I had like three major takeaways that I put at the very end of my notes on this, but the last one was, what capitalist realism has really done is it's replaced ideology with assumption. Like, there are ideological assumptions inherent to this system, but they're buried and you don't see them and you don't think about them, and the system itself never talks about them. It's just baked into the pie, so to speak. And examples being like, you can only accomplish progress through this business ontology. You can only determine value via a market sense. Anything that you can't assign a monetary value to is meaningless. Things like that. There's a whole lot of stuff that's just taken for granted by people, and they think that they live in this post-ideological world, but really it's not quite true. It's there. It's just hidden, and it's being used against you.
I mean, you see that with the mental health example and what he describes as reflexive impotence,
mm-hmm.
where he has a quite neat way of describing it, but basically that he has these students that don't know how to do anything but kind of passively consume, and that's the root of their unhappiness. But they can't conceive of a way out of unhappiness other than through passively consuming. In a weird way, there's this kind of capitalist logic to the main problem of mental health, which is like people are kind of in chase of dopamine and pleasure, in the same way like a capitalist is in chase of profit. But ultimately, it necessarily leads to a collapse, a tipping point, and then they fall into depression. But again, they're so enmeshed in that logic of consumption that. They can't conceive, you know, like he talks about the point of Nietzsche is the difficulty. They can't conceive of that a route to happiness could be discipline and dedication to something, and that happiness would be an effect. Happiness can't be an effect. It has to be something that's available immediately for consumption, that it's immediately accessible in the way everything else is. And that's precisely the root of their problem.
Yeah, and yeah. It's like I just want the Nietzsche flair to put on my uniform. I don't want to actually have to do the work. And I see this too with people that get into like weightlifting and bodybuilding. There's been a real huge uptick in people using performance enhancing drugs because they don't understand that part of physical training is the work itself and it's the process and what that does to your inner self whenever you commit to a very long period of training and structure and routine. They just want to get those muscles.
Yeah, then what does it turn to? What have we been talking to this whole thing? About pumping those numbers up. Well, literally pumping those numbers up. But what you guys are talking about, and what Keith was keying in on as well, is why irony then becomes intrinsic to the capitalist model. Like, it is like irony would not, irony in the form that we understand it could not exist outside of capitalism, because what ends up happening is you feel like the ironic person. So Lewis Hyde talks about this in his essay, Alcohol and Poetry, and he's doing this as an analysis of John Berryman's poetry. But he made an insight that astounded David Foster Wallace, and it was one that David Foster Wallace quoted in his own essay on television and irony, is that irony only has emergency use because it's a way that the slave, that the miserable, that the oppressed cope with mm-hmm. that with where they are.
It's a cope.
But it's also a way of attaining a small modicum of power because it's a reclamation thing as well. And Lewis Hyde famously put it that irony is the song of a bird that has come to love its cage. And what it ends up becoming is it's a way to assuage the guilt. Like, you feel guilty about being this crass consumer, but so what do you do? Like, oh, I'm ironically consuming it, and you're doing this in a way that you assuage the guilt of consumption until eventually one of two things have to happen. You either have to just admit the fact that this is not ironic after all, that, you know, today's irony is tomorrow's sincerity. Like, you have to admit that this is not an ironic thing, or you collapse into a complete state of irony poisoning where you have basically just induced a sort of a mental illness in yourself where you're no longer able to act, talk, or function like a normal human being would have been able to 10 years ago, where everything you say is now suffused completely in being sardonic. So even though you're trying to say something that you mean, you leave that constant escape hatch for you so that you can back off from it at any time because you're afraid of the whip coming down when the slave is getting too uppity.
Yeah, it seems like there's some parallels between that and ressentiment, but it might be a topic for another time.
I mean, you see this with millennials a lot. You know, the same people that'll scoff at religion or traditional source of meaning for people, or something like radical politics. You know, the same people that'll give you very nihilistic responses when they hear your politics, like, "Well, you know, we'll all be dead eventually," and or you know, the universe is just made of atoms and we're made of stardust, so it doesn't. None of this political stuff matters. That generation that has that very nihilistic lens on everything will, you know, cry at the end of Avengers, like, remember watching the last Avengers movie, and there was people around me crying about Tony Stark dying, and I just felt utter disgust. But it's like five minutes earlier, it's like the characters are making jokes, like self-aware jokes, like, oh, you know, this is the bit where we fight the bad guy or whatever, like reminding you that it's a movie. But in a weird way, that's kind of what facilitates them getting invested and crying over the dead character. This is something Zizek talks about, that in the Shrek movies, that there's always this layer of very cynical irony. But beneath that, it's just, a fairly standard telling of a fairy tale with all the typical archetypes and story arcs. And, you know, it's gotten to the point where that layer of irony is just there because it's necessary, because we need to see that to sort of give our permission to get invested. And that's what it's like with the Cape Shit movies. It's like it's all this cynicism and self-aware layers of irony. And, you know, the audience is in on the joke. It's all this, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod. And they feel very pleased with themselves that they're watching such a self-aware, cynical movie. But then at the same time, you know, they're crying over the death of a Cape Shit character. So, you know, behind the cynicism, they really are invested.
The reference is irony culture's first simulacrum of order, or first order of simulacrum. Mixed that up. But Alex and I are both millennials, and something you're talking, Alex and I had very different experiences growing up. We came from very different backgrounds, but I feel confident that he and I probably, just because of a very similar mindset that he and I have, that growing up with the generation that we did and growing up surrounded by the very lost sense of people that we were around, because that's at least with the education that I went into, the people I was surrounded by, and people my own age, because I grew up in a community. I grew up where I knew elderly people, and I took care of the younger kids when I had come of a certain age, and I had the sense of being around a very diverse age range of people that I could connect with on one level or another: neighbors, friends, family, relatives, cousins, all that stuff. And then I go into this college experience, and I'm only surrounded by people my own age. And there's this very deep sense of loss and being lost that I found among them. And any attempt to try and find something that was meaningful, that was worth reflecting on, that was worth believing in, that was worth embracing, that was worth fighting for, and that was worth the transcending against the fear of being cringe, like that was always looked at suspiciously at best. It was looked at suspiciously at best, and just bad and wrong at worst. And I don't know if you had a similar experience, Alex, of like the struggle of like people within our own age range of the way that they were trying to engage a culture that was quickly slipping them by.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, we I think are close to the same age, and
we
remember whenever reality truly hemorrhaged, and that was like 1999. Like that was sort of just like the end of all history.
Yeah,
I mean, it was on its last legs in the 90s, but like 99, I always kind of put that as being the year that things ended. I think I owe that to
good year for movies, though.
Yeah, I think it has to do with The Matrix, right? Yeah. The Matrix came out in 1999, and in The Matrix, that was like the last ideal year of humanity.
They perpetually were simulating 1999. That was probably the most on-point thing the movie ever did, and very few people picked up on that.
Yeah, they were right. That was basically when history ended, because after that, all the music genres died. And that's actually one of the things that I find, just on a side note, I find that very disturbing, is to look back at the 90s and then be like, wow, all of those music genres I used to listen to, they don't even exist. Rock music is dead. Rock music has been dead.
Everything now is just a corpse to be cannibalized.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I watched the death of entire genres. It's quite amazing. But yeah, you're talking about being lost. It's like even the children in Lord of the Flies had a more coherent worldview than millennials today.
I have the conch. I will speak.
Right. I mean, people kind of talk about Lord of the Flies as if it were chaos or something, but no. Compared to our system, no, they were pretty well put together.
Well, these were children that had a sense of what tribe meant and what the myth of the blood, the need for primal violence, like Golding tapped into that very deeply of what, like, and, you know, it's, and once again, like, you see this, like, this is the one of my favorite things that that this capitalist realist system does to education, and to, because I made kind of a reference to it with the way that they were doing these book shots and the way that they basically have destroyed literature and destroyed art and destroyed the way we engage with culture and the way we contextualize our lives within that, is how many people have had their love of books destroyed by having to read books in school because they're not taught correctly, they're taught wrong, they're given bad books to read, but mostly it's just like even good books are just taught wrong and they're not taught the right message, like they're not even taught what the book is about. Like Animal Farm, for instance, is probably one of the most Animal Farm and 1984, two of the most abused novels in the educational system that don't even get to the heart of what they're really about. And so people
fellas, I thought 1984 was meant to be a work of fiction, not a documentary, am I right?
Wow, that's really big brains.
Yeah, and it's such a sad thing because like on the example of Lord of the Flies. So this is like, wow, man, in any moment human beings can just descend into being total animals. That's like you can't really trust anybody, can you? It's just like, or like society just breaks down. That he's like, no, that's not even accurate. That's just not an accurate view of things, because society breaks down in very, very strange and peculiar ways, as we're seeing right now. Mm-hmm. It breaks down and it doesn't like turn into this orgy of violence unless you have particular people that are genetically well suited for that, but it doesn't break down the way that they're depicting in that. What that story is about that other animal side of us that does exist. And the two things are in constant, it's the constant tension between nature and civilization. And that's, but they don't teach you that in school. They don't teach you to appreciate that because you're not supposed to see nature as anything other than this weird, pretty commodity that you have, like when you grow up and you learn about how evil human beings are, now you need to go save it. It's like, no, like you have a nature and that's like, and that's beyond the numbers. It's not, there's no number to pump up here. It's not about pumping up the number of species. No, this is about what is my relationship to the entire ecological system and the nature that I descend into when I'm just being in nature, because nature is just being. But you can't have just being in a capitalist system. You have to be constantly on the move, on the go, and extracting resource.
Yeah, because it's a very totalitarian ideology, and that's one of the things that Fisher was talking about, is how capitalism tries to assign values and turn something into a capitalist process that it's actually impossible to do that with. Like, you can't actually put a value on this type of thing, but here capitalism is trying to do it. And he uses education as an example. Like, capitalism has never been able to figure out if the students are a consumer or a product. It doesn't know.
Yeah. No, although advertisers will tell you. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Keith.
Yeah, well, just touching on that with education, I mean, capitalist logic is bleeding over into education in other ways as well. Like, I remember, it seems to be getting to an earlier and earlier age where the justification for education is made around career growth. And remember, anytime teachers were asked to justify anything, it was on the basis that, well, we're going to get you, this will get you a high-paying job when you're older. And there's this constant discussion of, like any extracurricular activities that were done in school, any excursions that were brought on or whatever, was always justified on, well, this is going to look good on your CV, it's going to look good on your resume. And in a weird way, that constant, everyone has kind of internalized that, where they're constantly, they're constantly thinking of their resume and their future prospects and how these things are going to translate for employers. In a weird way, it's like the ultimate internalization of the capitalist logic. People have internalized selling themselves to employers, and to the point that they're justifying what should be meaningful activities through that. And the education system is more and more adapting to that logic as well. Like in Ireland, they've been considering for a while making Irish an optional subject. They made history an optional subject for people in high school, where it used to be mandatory. But what it's getting replaced with, it's getting replaced with things like IT.
Did you say history is an optional subject?
Yeah.
What?
It's incredible. But what they're replacing with is like IT and Mandarin and all these optional things. And it's like it's completely the logic of, we're going to make you like the ideal worker for one of these global homo corporations. You know, you leave school having IT skills and speaking some Mandarin for your Chinese employers, but.
Yeah, I'm still sort of like shell shocked here. Like, they've decided that, if, I guess, for your equivalent of high school, that you don't need to take history. Like, nah, so you don't need that.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to be optional. So you get taught history in like primary school up to the age of 12, and that'll be the extent of your knowledge.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, it's a wild thing, because they induce dissociative identity disorder in people, because you get taught all this stuff, and you're taught, again, like, going to the problem of even if they were to be taught history, Alex, like, a lot of them are just gonna have no, like, they don't give you the context for history either. So this is like, again, like going to the same exam, going to what I said about literature, they don't teach it correctly, or they don't teach it to have any real meaning for you. So then what does the student always ask after a certain point? It's like, how is this going to help me going mm-hmm. forward? Like, why do I need to learn this? And so they are caught between something that would be much more fulfilling in education, but they have no context for, towards something that would be more useful to them, like in order to advance in society, but it has no fundamental meaning to it. And it leads to that specialization that Keith was referring to, that everybody becomes an over-specialized scientist. And as any kind of biologist can tell you, over-specialization leads to death in a species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Fisher was quoting on this topic. He was talking about how Deleuze observes and controls societies, not only by Kafka himself, but also by Foucault and Burroughs, operate using indefinite postponement. And this idea that control societies are based on debt rather than closure. So you're basically indebted to your future self, and everything is aimed at what this future self is going to be able to do in the market. And this process extends throughout your entire lifespan. And there's this constant like retraining, like you would go through school, you'd be trained in some subject, and then you'd have to change your entire career path later on, because we don't have stable careers anymore. We have a gig economy, and we work from one gig to the next gig, and we're constantly demanded on, the demand is put on us to be in a state of flux, right? Like, we're just always in a state of flux. We're supposed to be able to immediately adapt to whatever the changing circumstances are. And the idea of demanding a more stable environment is like some sort of insanity.
Yeah, the best expression as well is, again, this is something that Zizek talks about, but where it's like it moved from the disciplinary father that told you, you know, you had to go and visit your relatives because if you didn't, he'd smack you, to, you should go and visit your relatives because they'll be so happy to see you, or whatever. That this logic sort of bleeds over, where you have the, in corporate work environments now, it's like the performance view, where your employer is like talking to you about ways you could maybe improve yourself, and how do you think we could improve, and you know, we're going to work together with you, like to make you a better worker for us. It's, yeah, this very sort of soft semen, but at the same time very, very totalizing approach to managing people.
There was this really bug band musician, Jonathan Colton, who did the song to that game Portal, and he did this is like all proto bug man stuff. He did very, very nerdy music. He was one of the first guys to do that horrible, horrible fad that they had going on in the aughts. This is one of the worst musical fads, by the way, of having people do like soft acoustic covers of hip hop songs. Like, you want to talk about fucking cringe? Like, one of the worst. Like, he started, but he had a song about zombies, which was big back, which was, again, one of those cringe trends from the aughts. But he had a song about zombies where it was sung from the point of view of the boss of a human character who had been turned into a zombie, and you have a zombie who's still speaking in all this corporate jargon about how, well, we need to work together, and like, I hope you can see things my way. And it's like, you know, like, there's no I in team and all this stuff. And he's fundamentally talking about, through all this corporate jargon, about like, well, Tom, I'm going to eat your brains, and you need to work with me on this.
That's funny, sneaking in a reference to pea zombies there, but
yeah. No, it's but I mean, like, it's an actual zombie talking about, like, as your corporate boss, like, telling, like, explaining to you in that way of, like, where they try to guilt trip you or mess with you or trick you into basically being the compliant language of corporations, of how, like, you need to work with me on this so that I can get access to your brain and eat that.
Yeah, I wanted to touch real quick on something Keith was referring to, which there's a great quote in here about in a culture in which the paternal concept of duty has been subsumed into the maternal imperative to enjoy, it can seem that the parent is failing their duty if they in any way impede their children's absolute right to enjoyment. And maybe this is where Mark Fisher could have gotten in trouble with some of the other leftists, because he seems to still be using this paradigm of paternal, maternal, you know. He's not really attacking that. And then he points out that our model of health is based on this sort of reductionist idea that it's all about your future potential for hedonism, and you don't want to do anything that could impede that. It's not like you would be healthy for the sake of being healthy itself. It's you're healthy so that you can consume product later on.
Yeah, and as you were, Keith, you were mentioning before the show that, I don't think we were able to confirm that, but I wouldn't, I mean, I believe it totally, but that he was, so for people who aren't aware, I think we mentioned it at the start of it, but he committed suicide in 2017. He was noted to have struggled with mental illness, especially depression. I can't remember if he was bipolar or not, but Keith, you mentioned that you believe that he had been harassed and hounded quite a bit for these more heterodox essays by the transgender Antifa types, which I would have no trouble believing one bit.
Yeah, I remember reading about this the first time I read this. I could be wrong on this, but I'm quite sure that he got torrents of abuse and threats from that community because I'm not sure, actually. I think you know the essay, but I'm not sure what it was exactly that set them off. But yeah, apparently he got badly hounded.
His most controversial essay apparently was an essay called "Exiting the Vampire Castle," and I don't know if that's the one where, because he was call out culture, cancel, which becomes cancel culture. That has always existed since you always had the PC, the quote unquote PC culture in the 90s. Kaczynski was talking about this in Industrial Society and its future, and using it as a way of showing how he was one of the earliest people to point out that leftists should always be barred from engaging in revolutionary activity because they always betray revolution because of these political. Whatever you want to call them, identity, boutique issues, all of the stuff, like the SJWs, and we're all familiar, like, pick whatever term you want to use. We all know what we're talking about here. But he Kaczynski had seen that these people will immediately turn back on any revolutionary potential because they're more concerned with that than in pursuing the actual goal. And we see this off the way that the Antifa types police, making sure, like, they spend more time worrying about what the working class thinks than helping the working class. But Fisher was seeing this as well with the evolution of, like, as PC culture became call-out culture, we're now seeing the next form of that in cancel culture evolved into the other, and they all have accelerated to the point they are now. We're seeing this instantaneous cancellation that occurs on Twitter where, I mean, it is now beginning to have much more real-world consequences because these people have seen that they can begin to back that with threats of violence and not have any, and not be knocked down for that. And when there's no stoppage to that, well, I mean, we know who's in charge then, or at least in charge of that level of policing. They have a level of cultural policing that they are allowed to do by capitalism because they're quite good at it. That's why I coined the term Tranissaries. Like, they function as Janissaries for an Ottoman neo-Ottoman capitalism, as it were.
Yeah. Spandrel had that essay about bio-Leninism, which describes that archetype of this, these sorts of misfits that you can get, the system can get absolute loyalty from them because they give them power. And these spiteful mutants realize the only way they get to exercise power is via this establishment granting it to them. So they become intensely loyal and they become the perfect Janissaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also, I mean, we often talk about, how, you know, the Antifa types are the foot soldiers of neoliberalism, which is true. But there's also, there's another aspect to that, which is they're the perfect expression of this this idea of late capitalism as schizophrenia. This idea that Deleuze and Guattari have, that it's fundamentally schizo in nature, and that it requires the lack of a real identity. Everything has to be fluid. But at the same time, there's this tension in that there has to be the lack of a solid identity, but one has to be constantly adopting identities and egos. And so, you know, the ideal of capitalism is the person without a fundamental identity that can purchase and swap identities easily. And, you know, those sort of gender fluid Antifa types are a perfect example of that schizo nature.
Yeah, that's something Rick Roderick was talking about in the 1990s, was the adoption and rejection of identity constantly. Just, you know, one week you're a preppy, and then the next week you're a redneck, and then after that you decide you become a poet.
So, and I was, while we were talking, I was looking at this Exiting the Vampire Castle essay, and so I can see now why it was controversial among the people it was controversial with, because this, which was, I believe it was originally published in 2013. So, but much like how capitalist realism being published in 2009, being where thing had an accurate picture of where things were going on the capitalist side of things, his essay Inside the Vampire's Castle was seeing the way that I use the term before, but like, this is a term I've seen used, is the Great Awakening, where things move towards this quote-unquote wokeness. He was charting this as well. And so what he was describing of being inside the vampire's castle was essentially like many of the stuff that Mulbug was describing with the cathedral and the Dark Enlightenment people were all describing. So I'm going to just summarize what he called the laws of the vampire castles. So the first configuration is what I came to call the vampire's castle. The vampire's castle specializes in propagating guilt. It is driven by a priest's desire to excommunicate and condemn, an academic pedant's desire to be the first to be seen to spot a mistake, and a hipster's desire to be one of the in crowd. And so he describes all the laws here. The first law of the vampire's castle is individualize and privatize everything. The second law of the vampire's castle is make thought and action appear very, very difficult. The third law of the vampire's castle is propagate as much guilt as you can. The fourth law of the vampire's castle is essentialize. And the fifth law of the vampire's castle, think like a liberal because you are one. And he was writing this in the context. He was writing this in the context because of attacks that Brand had received of trying to advocate for the working class and him being seen as an inauthentic fraud. And he found this very peculiar in that it seemed that there was no way for the working class to be able to have any level of advocacy because things would quickly go into this form of the vampire's castle.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. Think like a liberal because you're a liberal. Makes me remember Daniel Harper for some reason.
Yeah. Think like a liberal, Daniel Harper, because you are one.
But yeah, there's so much gold in this this thing. Because I feel like we keep coming back around to the concept of irony and some of the stuff we see in, I guess, individuals that are parallel to us in some respect. But he was talking about the big other, which I think is a concept from Lacan, right? The big other is essentially what irony bros think they're appealing to. It's the normie. Like, well, you gotta do respectability politics because the big normie is watching. And they don't want to upset the big normie.
By the way, you're correct. That is a Lacanian concept that comes from Jacques Lacan. But like, that's something you and I have talked about, Alex. Is like we've called it the fetishization of the normie. And that's the question we've always asked. Like, have you ever actually talked to a normal person? Like, set aside the question, like, what even is a normal person anymore in the way that this society has caused people to internalize horrible, horrible narratives? Like, set that question aside, because that's a completely different conversation. Have you ever actually talked to a normal person and gotten a sense of what they are, who they are, and what they actually care about, and what they're willing to talk about? I mean, we've made up the idea like, oh, the skittish normie who's like the like this gentle doe, and if you just use the wrong word, it's like a, like stepping on a stick that causes it to scatter into the woods. It's like, that's like, again, I ask, where are the, like, have you been to these barbecues that you imagine, the kind of trad calf neighborhood barbecues that you imagine that they must be having, and where they talk about how, you know, like, they're not sure how to contextualize, like, what's the proper immigration plan? Like, have you actually ever talked to a person like that?
Yeah,
have you ever
talked to a normal person? It's the reification fallacy. Like, it's how the Big Other works. It's a giant reification fallacy. It's an abstraction that is basically misplaced concreteness. Like, there is no normie, right? It doesn't exist. You're thinking about an abstract thing that's not even there, and then you're calibrating your approach to issues based on how you think you should interact with this abstraction. So you're really just sort of deceiving yourself the entire time.
And if society is atomized the way that, I mean, I think we can say, like, the United States is the most diverse society on Earth, and it's so because of the level of capitalism here as well, it by nature has to be the most atomized society. And that's not, you know, we already had a level of regionalism to begin with, but you've seen this ramping up of atomization within the last two decades. What is a normie in a situation like, how you can't, like, you cannot have a normie in an atomized society? That is literally impossible. By its very nature, an atomized society individualizes to the point that normalcy can no longer exist. So what is a normie then?
But it's also kind of strangely liberal, or I guess it's a weird kind of capitalist approach to politics and ideology, where it's like, we need to present the best possible product to the market. You know, we need we need to turn our ideology into the most consumable, the ideology with the most appeal that the most amount of people are going to want to purchase. So yeah, it's which doesn't reflect any reality in terms of how power actually works. But yeah, it's the capitalist realism. It's internalizing this capitalist approach to everything.
Yeah,
and because a lot of these people are ironic, it's like that's why they have to think that way. Because, like we pointed out, irony goes hand in hand with capitalistic consumption, because it requires, like, that's the leveling mechanism. That's the mechanism that deals with, like, the dissonance and the guilt that arises from the way that you're participating in this. I mean, this is something that leftists have obsessed over. Like, is there such a thing as ethical consumption under capitalism? They have debates the way that quantum physicists debate the entire, like, debate wave functions. Like, that's like how far many of the leftists go in terms of trying to understand, is there such a thing as ethical consumption under capitalism?
Yeah.
That debate has made them gone completely off the rails and completely insane. But people who are on, like, the ironic right, they're the dark mirror of that. They have just, like, they're dealing with the guilt of that unethical consumption, because they internalize that this is an unethical consumption. How do I assuage my guilt? And that begins to form the way that they put their, like, they put their narratives out there, and they're trying to sell their narratives. They become the salesmen themselves.
Yeah. Irony is your permission slip to do these things. And I have a friend who's talked many times about anarchists, like these hardcore anarchists and leftists that will ironically go to McDonald's. Like, I'm going to ironically enjoy this this cheeseburger. it's amazing, right?
Yeah. And it's like, what are you doing, guy? This goes again, like, then what do they become when they do, like, this is like, this, there's a formula to this thing, and that's like, and it's because capitalism works well with formulas. What happens when you do the ironic consumption? You become the critic, and you become this ironic critic, and you make this whole performance to this, and now you're beginning to sell your criticism as an entertainment, and now people are consuming your criticism. So you are ironically consuming McDonald's, and then you put on the ironic performance for other people, because, like, this is the way that these things build upon each other, and now people are consuming you, consuming a product.
Yeah. What about there's a TV show you might appreciate, this, that's very popular in the UK, called Gogglebox, where you watch people watching television from the week.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Look, I mean, Korea, the South Korea is an interesting, fascinating example, like, where you see hyper-capitalism in a different cultural context and the way that it begins to manifest there, because the mukbang, or mukbang, I forget how they use pronounce, I think it's mukbang, the mukbang phenomenon in Korea, because Koreans have a deep appreciation for food. And in Korean culture, you don't eat alone. Like, it's a very, 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 very weird thing to eat alone. Like, you will get weird looks in Korea if you eat alone, because they're much more are much more tied to community in their history, and especially in their recent history, because they have so many people have their grandparents and great grandparents that are telling them how things used to be, like under the Japanese occupation and all that. So they still have this weird, like, they have an idea of a memory of the past, and so they're still rooted in this idea that you have to eat together. But so how does capitalism in this very individualized and atomized Korean society begin to work with this cultural thing? They make the mukbang where people now people watch other people eat food for entertainment. You watch somebody else eat to entertain yourself. This is a very popular form of online internet media in Korea, the mukbang.
Do you know, there's something else as well. I think I did a video about this before, but commodification seems to be moving to commodifying experiences. You know, it's like we've kind of reached a limit in terms of like selling people product. Like, I mean, you see kind of a contrast with immigrants to Western countries and natives of Western countries, in that the immigrants are much more impressed by the Nike trainers or whatever, all the flashy products. But there's a kind of jadedness to the natives around that that form of consumption, but they're just replacing that with the, you know, going to India to take a boat on the River Ganges or something, or you know, all the ways that experience are being commodified. Like, if you look at the growth of the airline industry the last few years and how much commercial travel is increasing, it's absolutely massive. And the Christmas present now isn't the games console. It's a voucher to go skydiving or something. So they're more and more trying to fill that void of authentic experience with product. You know, the experience now is what you buy.
Yeah. Speaking of trying to like buy the authentic experience, Leonid Svartzen brings up one of my favorite internet examples, the ASMR video phenomenon.
Oh God.
Because like, yes, I mean,
we're like, going into a very dark place now.
We are going into a very, very dark place. But, like, can there be a greater statement on how loveless and the problems of intimacy that your society has encountered, where people are now purchasing a very safe and very stylized and very hyper real form of intimacy? Because that's what ASMR is now. There is that kind of like effect that does happen, that can be triggered by various noises. But what the most popular videos in the ASMR genre are, a lot of them are role play videos, and it's with women, of course. So of course, you know, like the largest consumer of these things are largely going to be men, because of the situation we're in, and the sex disparity we're beginning to see in terms of relationships in the Western world. So, but there's also that inherent fear of the relationship now, because of all the because of the way that they've been framed for us in capitalist realism, the way we don't understand how to just be in a relationship anymore. There's a level of commodification and a level of expectation and narrative that goes into that make people almost unable to even deal with relationships anymore. So what do they do instead? They buy a hype. Look at the Patreon numbers. Sometimes people look at the Patreon numbers. They buy a very safe, very intense, and hyper real form of the intimacy experience that they can play over and over again, and they can even request very specific things. You can now design, instead of intimacy being this thing that just happens in the moment, that's the magic of being a human being, like, you can now boutique design your own intimate experience.
Well, I know that there's also a thing where people pay for cuddle sessions.
Yeah.
Not sex, but just to cuddle with someone. Like, that's a product you purchase now, the cuddle experience.
I mean, the sexual kink has always existed in the seedy underbelly of the world. Like, that has always been a problem that societies have had to confront with and try to keep tamped down. But we are now at the point where people, and so those were always very specific paraphilias. We are now at the point where paraphilia has become part of intimacy itself, and now people want very specific intimate experiences, very specific non-sexual intimate experiences where they begin to design it, and the fantasy becomes so overwhelming because they would never be able to settle for the real thing anymore if they were even able to get it.
Yeah, it's there are certain experiences and things in society that have been sort of disassembled and then repackaged as products. You know, it used to be this is just how things were, like having neighbors that would watch your kids has been replaced by daycare, going to church to meet your future wife. Well, we don't do that anymore. We have a dating service. We have an application that uses an algorithm to help find you a lover, because we have essentially destroyed those older social networks that everyone took for granted. And that if you approach it from the sort of libertarian free market capitalist point of view, you don't even see the value of those social networks. It's hard for you to even quantify that what they do or how they would exist.
You can't even conceive of it, because it used to be like young men have always had problems with women. It's just like, that's just how it is. In a civilization, things become a bit more because like you're a little bit more in order to pursue a cohesive society. There is a certain separation from nature that has to occur. And so you lose a little bit of that. And so civilized men there's always been at least a little bit of a struggle with women, which is why the community aspect was so important to that. Who entered into the picture? You had the patriarchal father or old man in the community who could make a strong choice, who could, you know, tell you, basically be that guiding patriarchal figure. But you also had the older matchmaker who could help basically young men and young women begin to help them get together to help set up these matches that would work, because frankly, men and women just like in a civilized society will have those issues. It happens. That's why the community is the safety net that catches that and is supposed to prevent that from happening. But then when you go towards this both capitalist and technological system, you first of all separate people from each other. You separate, instead of having this contact with different age groups and different levels of wisdom, everyone's segregated into age groups, so nobody can really help one another. And especially within the same age group, a competition effect is always going to occur within that. So these things become much more fraught. But then when you remove that as well, and then you add things like apps and all that, like now capitalism is your matchmaker. Do you want capitalism to be your matchmaker? Because that's what you got now. That's what you got. Capitalism is your matchmaker. Instead of having somebody, an old crone that, okay, maybe she's a little bit weird, but she's had some experience. She might be able to help you make a few good decisions instead of swiping left and right and not knowing what you're doing.
Now, I wanted to get to this other thing, this insight that Fisher was having. It's a little bit of a different subject, but he was talking about the market Stalinism and the bureaucratic nature of the current power structures. And this is something that speaks to our experience, because everybody has this sort of, I think they're coming to this understanding that ultimately there is no real person behind the curtain, like pulling the strings here. Like there is no final sort of authority. There is no final manager, like the final boss, like the final manager you can speak to.
Exactly. And adding to that gamification, there is no final boss.
Yeah. And Fisher talks about the call center experience, which is probably the best way to explain this. The call center experience distills the political phenomenology of late capitalism, the boredom and frustration punctuated by cheerily piped PR, the repeating of the same dreary details many times, different poorly trained, badly informed operatives, the building rage that must remain impotent because it can have no legitimate object, since, as is very quickly clear to the caller, there is no one who knows and no one who could do anything even if they could. Anger can only be a matter of venting it. It is aggression in a vacuum. And that's basically our politics, right? It's just aggression in a vacuum at this point, directed at someone who is a fellow victim of the system, but with whom there is no possibility of communality. Just as anger has no proper object, it will have no effect. In this experience of a system that's unresponsive, impersonal, centerless, abstract, and fragmentary, you're as close as you can be to confronting the artificial stupidity of capital in itself. And that's pretty much how the political systems work. It's like, well, who do I hold? Do I hold Donald Trump responsible for the way things are going? Which functionary is really responsible? No one is. Like, everyone is simultaneously responsible and not responsible.
Yeah, libertarians and conservatives make the argument in favor of privatization and free enterprise that it's just simply more efficient. Well, it is efficient. It's efficient in making sure that responsibility is diffused to the point that there is no one place for the buck to stop. So that that again goes to its amorphous quality. So that when a piece of it goes down, it can just be a temporary retreat and it will reconstitute as the whole because it's just. That's just what it is. It's a blob. It's just a blob.
Yeah, and this process has been ongoing for a long time. It's something Foucault was talking about in Discipline and Punish, is that instead of having the sovereign, which is obviously all of that power is right there in the sovereign, like you know where the buck stops. It stops at the sovereign. And then this became dispersed into institutions. And that made the institutions, I think, were much more metastable than the old sovereign because it's much harder to direct your ire at an institution like a prison system or a justice system. And now we've gone a step further that into what Deleuze is talking about with control societies, where the power is, it's now dispersed so laterally that you're just in a matrix of constant control and there is no one actually behind the wheel anymore.
The purpose of the public execution, as Foucault noted, was to demonstrate the power of the sovereign, to show who the sovereign was and what the sovereign was capable of doing. Under this system, there is no public execution by a single executioner that's directed by a sovereign. They basically just crash your social credit score and drive your actual financial credit score. They just push the numbers down. We're going to pump, like, oh, you're going against us? Well, we're just going to pump a bunch of us that you can't see who we are. We're just going to pump your numbers down.
Yeah, and we had a conversation about this yesterday about, well, what is like the dominant power source? Well, it's or the instrument of control in this system. And it's no longer the traditional disciplinary system of prison and courts and things like that. That's not how it's done anymore. It's done primarily through this sort of dispersed, crowdsourced social media control mechanism, like the media itself. For example, we had that story of the Minneapolis cop that was kneeling on this guy's neck and basically suffocated him to death. So the way that power is constructed now, it's not the cop doing this to this black guy. That's not how it works. It's actually the media story and contextualization about it. That is how power is now exercised.
I've been getting really excitable and talking a lot. Keith, did you have anything on this?
Well, you know, it was kind of interesting. The last couple of days have been like, I've had people flaming at me because I put out a clip that I did with Tyler Hamilton where we discussed cultural Marxism versus cultural capitalism. And, you know, we acknowledged the effect that the ideas of people like Marcuse had. But we said, look, the only reason that these were adopted by the system is because they serve power very well. And that, you know, exactly what Alex is discussing, that capitalism, neoliberalism needs to de-translate identities, I think is how Deleuze described it, that you need to take apart identities so that that void can be filled by consumption, this de-translation, re-translation process. And that the reason that the ideas of the cultural Marxists were adopted was precisely because they accelerated this. And precisely because they had abandoned traditional Marxism and their ideas were perfect for accelerating into this kind of post-1960s, post-Fordist capitalism where everything was more fluid, where things like, you know, the traditional family structure, the traditional employment structure could be deconstructed and taken apart. And people got very angry at that and pushed back a lot. And what was interesting is that, you know, even though people in this space will call themselves, I don't know, third position or national socialist or anti-capitalist, was they were still really clinging, I noticed, clinging to, well, you know, if we could have just preserved like 1950s American capitalism, everything would be fine. And the problem was just this subversion here, this going wrong here. And it's like, sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought there. But yeah, this desire to return to like a perfect time period of capitalism, it's this kind of a denial of the fundamental nature of capital, which is to de-translate these identities. And in a weird way, this idea of the long march through the institutions and Gramsci and Marxists coming and just kind of derailing Western civilization from under everyone's nose, this kind of feeds into the capitalist realism that you find in dissident space as well, and an unwillingness to accept this structure problem that basically, you know, with capital, we're all fucked. It's this constant, it plays into a victim narrative as well, but this constant need to find a sort of reductionist single point where this is where, you know, this is where the West was subverted, rather than, you know, this kind of call center experience of it is the progress of capital that is destroying these things, because that's a much more fundamental problem. Because people, a lot of these people, their whole conception of Western civilization is the capitalist West. It is kind of an idealization of like 1950s America and the nuclear family, which in itself is, funny enough, was kind of a breakdown of more traditional forms of family organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think you have to have a radical skepticism of capitalism itself and the assumptions baked into capitalism if you're going to call yourself a thinker or I don't know, a challenge to the current system. Like,
but we're the thinkery now, Alex.
Yeah.
move over Sargon. We're the
But I mean, really, you can't keep having this battered wife syndrome with capitalism and the current system. Like, you can't have your cake and eat it too. I'm sorry, you just can't do it.
I try not to be. I don't, because there are really good people. They're really nice people, and I know for some of them, they just like the aesthetic of it, or they like what they have conceptualized it represents, that of like the idea of having access to a nice normal life. That's where a lot of that sentiment comes from, but I don't like it when people go towards of elevating these 1950s advertisements as a model for anything. I understand, like, more than often than that, that's just a symbol for a chance at a normal society, a normal life. So I don't object to it on that grounds. But I mean, the problem is there's no such thing as a neutral image. McLuhan's right, for one, that the medium is the message, and that the medium tends to matter more than the content itself. But even then, within the content, like, there are certain things that are signaled by that, and those advertisements, for instance, represent an era that have a lot of problems inherent in them. Like, you have, I remember I was talking with I was tweeting back and forth with my friend. I think it was Blauergeist on Twitter. He's a fantastic account. Yeah, it was Blauergeist, though, because we were looking at 1950s pharmaceutical advertisements. So, like, we have this, and this goes to something like, we have this idea of what each decade represents, but these things get really, because it's condensed images. And these memories that aren't even our own memories, they're memories that are imparted upon us. We have a really poor conception of what the recent past actually looked like. So this is the idea of the 1950s. It's like, I guarantee you, even your idea, to the vague audience out there, your idea of what the 1950s were like is wrong. You're just like, I guarantee you do not have an accurate picture of it. And one thing, for example, is the way that, like, how haphazardly they were advertising these horrible pharmaceuticals to women as a way, and what they were supposed to do for them. I mean, this is how you ended up with the thalidomide scandal, where women were having mutilated babies because it was just like, there was no consideration for the kind of stuff that they were putting out there. They were pursuing, they had created an image for people in the 1950s to chase and follow, and they did, and people got hurt by that. People got medically hurt by that because of the kind of pharmaceuticals they were putting out there. It's like, you know, we talk about the way that they overprescribed medication. They were doing this stuff in the 1950s. It started in the 1950s, this overprescription, and them having no idea what these chemicals are doing.
Yeah, well, I don't think you can talk about the 1950s in America without noting that itself was an artificial time period. Like, it was that prosperity and that lifestyle was the result of basically the United States and the other allies just bombing the shit out of the rest of the world. So we had the human capital stock, and we had a country that was basically untouched by war. So of course our industry prospered. Of course people had plenty of money and a nice lifestyle. But that's artificial. That's not sustainable forever.
And not only is it not sustainable forever, you're robbing the future generations as well. And that's that, to have that, like, well, I mean, like, well, we've seen the generation that grew up in that time period, what their mindsets are. Like, I will always take the nuanced view on boomers, but it is undeniable that much of their way that they their per, that we've the way that people complain about their financial and spending habits and the way that they view their financial duty to the younger generations and the future generations, a lot of that was formed by the fact that they were children in the 1950s. And this was the post-war attitude of that. Now, just like much like the way that millennials are, millennials didn't raise themselves. Boomers didn't raise themselves either. These are just the consequences of what was going on in the time period and the kind of messaging that was going on, the way that the capitalist structure, the capitalist was structuring itself in that specific time period. It evolves and changes and tests different things out, or it does a lot of different things in order to keep the thing going and keep expanding where it get into. Like, it's capitalism is never going to stop. It's going to keep trying to commodify everything until it can commodify commodity itself.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people to think about the fact that there's diminishing returns to everything, particularly capitalism, particularly this type of system of consumerism. Like, how much do you really need? Should be a question. How much technology do you really need? Like, I mow my grass with one of these real mowers, and that's a technology from like the 1850s or something. But it's efficient, it's cheap, it does a better job than a gas mower. And it's like, well, why did we need the gas mower? Like, if you have a small yard, why do you even need that? Why do you need this product? Why do you need anything more than a bicycle in a lot of places? Why do you need to have this piece of technology over here? Is that really helping me that much versus this other simpler form of technology? You kind of see that with like Mennonite communities and the Amish, that they figured it. I think they kind of figured this out to an extent, like, that's enough technology for us. We're going to stop right here, because more technology than that is actually hurting, not helping.
John Michael Greer actually mentions this in Dark Age America, that with this problem of technology is that people are so, it's the cult of progress is what it is, but there's, it's capitalism's cult of progress. They're so bought into this idea, well, this technology is supposed to help me. And there are technological advances that have objectively improved lives, but on the smaller, more micro level of technology helping the individual person, they're so bought into that. Greer points out they spend more time trying to go and find technology to make their lives supposedly more efficient, that they're actually making their lives more inefficient by pursuing this.
Yeah, absolutely. And then actually, Keith, I did listen to that the podcast you're talking about. You're discussing Gramsci and Marcuse, because I have some Marcuse and a Rem. I also agree. I think that a lot of that influence was somewhat overstated. Like, yeah, They had an idea about marching through institutions. They articulated that, and it's probably true to an extent. But the way that it has been disseminated into the structure of life itself now, that is due to capitalism repackaging that and using it for their own interests.
Yeah, well, it's this very kind of liberal view of power, isn't it? That, like, you come up with ideas and you get them into academia and you disseminate them amongst people, and then, like, you win. It's... You know, it's kind of a naive view of power in that it doesn't want to look at like structural reasons of like, well, why did the US in the 60s, you know, why did the CIA, why was this suited to the Americanism of the 1960s and to American empire?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what essentially happened here is they were able to defang communism and leftism. They incorporated certain elements and then redirected it into something totally harmless. I know that in capitalist realism, Mark Fisher talks about the Live 8 protests, or not protests, whatever it was, some sort of thing about ending world poverty. But by that point, capitalist realism, it's so subsumed everything that no one could think outside the box of other than just, we need to just use capitalist processes to get more money to the impoverished.
Well, isn't the perfect example of this now the environmental movement?
Yes, yeah, yeah. That I was going to bring that up at documentary, Planet of the Humans.
Planet of the Humans, yeah.
Yeah, it goes into
which was removed by YouTube yesterday, yeah. I think, or the day before.
Yeah, because it pulled the curtain back, and it's like showing, because I think the most interesting part of Planet of the Humans was, of course, these like Earth Day events, which are just massive corporate orgies. That's what it is. It's just an orgy of consumer capitalism masquerading as some kind of political activism or some sort of it's basically like a hot topic anarchy or something, you know?
Like, all mainstream environmentalism and mainstream green politics is still promising a more prosperous future for everyone.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we're going to bring everyone out of poverty. We're still going to give the third world a first world lifestyle. You know, we're not going to do any harsh measures. We're not going to focus on birth rates, but basically we're going to have like the 1950s, but it's going to be with windmills instead of burning oil. So yeah, I mean, there's a complete disconnect. And yeah, it's funny because Fisher talked about the environmental movement as potentially one of the best sources of revolt against capitalist realism, because it's this immediate rejection of the whole premise of capitalism. Like, you can't have endless growth. This system will collapse. Our grandchildren's life is going to be worse than our grandparents. You know, it just destroys the whole foundational myths of capitalism. But I mean, what has that become now? I mean, you don't see these more realistic, pragmatic discussions. You don't see it talked about that, you know, that, I mean, 97% of food production since the Green Revolution, 97% of our food production is from energy from fossil fuels. And, you know, we rely on all these minerals and so on for fertilizers that are due to reach peak in the next decade or two decades. And you don't see these discussions. Even the environmentalists, even the radical environmentalists, are still factoring in a constantly growing population up to 11 billion for the next century. So they're not actually challenging capitalist realism at all, because they're still trying to find a way to maintain a constant GDP growth, constant lifting up of impoverished countries. But you know, they just want to add the sustainability aspect to it.
Yeah. This is where the original Pine Bros, where Graph Twitter came out of, was because of exactly what Fisher is talking about, the failures of the environmentalist movement, the betrayal of what it was supposed to represent and what it was supposed to be in favor of. Because all the things you guys are describing are all the critiques that various people that were in the collapsitarian thing, which later influenced the Pine Bros and Graph Twitter. This is what they're trying to, trying a course correction. Obviously, there's no NGOs to back us. There's no power to back us on that. So we're just lone voices in the wilderness trying to point out what's really the obvious when you think about it for more than a couple minutes. But I mean, there's that famous quote from Alfred North Whitehead, which is very pertinent here. The major advances in civilization are processes which all but wreck the societies in which they occur.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of sort of like Joseph Tanner talking about, you have to have a sort of adult conversation about these things and say, well, what can we actually accomplish here? How much is our lifestyle going to have to necessarily change if we really want to get something done? And, oh gosh, I lost my train of thought. I guess I've been going at this for, what, 2 hours?
Yeah, I mean, you guys want to get on to some, get on to anything you didn't talk about with Fisher and then get out of here?
We could. I'll let Keith go. I'm going to look over my notes here.
There was something I was going to say. I can't remember what, like 5 minutes ago, you were saying something about people. Okay, I can't remember the context of what it was in, but there was actually a paper I was reading recently about how it actually surveyed like fairly upper middle class, fairly wealthy professionals, mostly females, and it came to some kind of seemingly contradictory, strange conclusions. But one of the things that the researchers were surprised at was that these professionals spend 50 to 60 hours a week in their workplace, but they tended to invest their money. They tend to spend an awful lot of money on things like things that they'll never get to enjoy while they're working 50 or 60 hours a week. Basically, you know, that they were putting tens of thousands mm-hmm. into upgrading their kitchen and so on, and having all these kitchen appliances, yet they never used them in the week. And the conclusion was that it was these things were being purchased more as a relic to the life that they wished they had, and that. In a weird way, there's this kind of logic in capitalism and in work that the ultimate luxury or the ultimate final end is to live in constant leisure. And the celebrity is kind of held up as the archetype of that. They're, you know, they just live in leisure, you know, someone like the Kardashians. But in this weird way, it's like we, on some level, we know that we don't need... in the case of these professionals, they know that they don't need as much as they work for. They know that they don't need $100,000 a year to live. But for whatever reason, they can't abandon that. And so they purchase these things and they spend money on these things. And they tailor their consumption to fit what they're earning to kind of justify how embedded they are in that system and how much of their time they're losing over to work.
Oh yeah, go ahead, Alex.
That reminds me of that's like a theme from Fight Club, right? Like the central protagonist, he's just buying all of this stuff, like all of this like this
hey decoration man, the things you own end up owning you.
Yeah, I think it's like a very good like example of a film that ties into this, because he basically has this like a break with reality. He forms a completely secondary personality as a result of this internal conflict about the demands of capitalist realism. What it does to his psyche.
Well, and that movie ends up hitting upon a point. All right, guys, drink, because I'm going to say it. He ends up hitting on a point that Baudrillard makes at the end of Simulation and Simulacrum, where like the final essay on nihilism, and then Baudrillard would later go on to go write a whole book on this subject in light of what in light of 9/11, is that in the nihilistic age, which in really what Baudrillard is really getting into, is the capitalist realism age, where there is no meaning in anything, because everything is like meaning itself has been commodified. Is he saw that the only thing that stood out were ostentatious forms of terrorism, and he warned that that's where the seduction begins, is when it gets to that point. Now he would go on to write a very controversial book on this called The Spirit of Terrorism. What Baudrillard saw was that they had the way that the system was now, the only thing that could really catch the attention and stay outside of the commodification process and these orders of simulacrum to be able to like infuse any sort of reality back into it was the spirit of terrorism. But we've seen now that there's a real problem with that as well, where because of the and I think he was aware of like this problem, like of what happens when things become too media oriented. Like now, terrorism itself has become so nihilistic and disjointed that it can't even reach the kind of sublime thing that Baudrillard was talking about. I mean, like look at how weird terrorism has become, and how now it has become almost commodified itself. Like there are now people, like we are getting to the point where now people like. Much like unfortunately, like you know, put me in the screen cap. It's not going to be long before people mm-hmm. want to be in the video where when the terrorism is going off. You're already seeing people making sure they're getting the perfect selfies when they're lighting things on fire and buildings yep. are burning. We saw that with Notre Dame. Yeah.
Also, it's kind of similar to what he talked about with the call center, where there's no single actor you can hold responsible, so it's just this pointless kind of lashing out. You see this with the lone wolf terrorist attacks, where you know, if you look at something like the terrorism of the IRA or something, it was like targeting economic targets, political targets. You know, they tried to blow up Downing Street, they bombed Canary Wharf in London, but it's like modern, you know, terrorism in the 21st century is just like going into a shopping mall or a mosque or a church or something and just gunning down random innocent people. And it has no structural effect at all, except that the system is so anti-fragile that this act becomes like another data point that the system can use to crack down and to predict the behavior of people in the milieu that this person was supposedly representing and trying to further. So it's completely self-defeating. It helps the system through its anti-fragile nature, and it is just this kind of lashing out where there's a complete lack of a center.
Yeah.
Yeah, that reminds me. So I don't think we'll do this now, but I want to at some point discuss the process of how the individual has become the individual, as Deleuze talks about. Like, even the idea that you're an individual partaking in this capitalist system is not actually true. What you are is like an aggregate of statistically predictable interests and desires. Like, you as an independent person have also been sliced apart and just turned into this sort of data, this aggregate, this faceless thing, this human capital stock as
a body without organs.
Yeah.
what was that guy that wrote Sapiens? That Jewish guy. He wrote a couple of really popular books. One of them was Sapiens.
The one that's A Brief History of Humankind? Harari?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like his whole thing. I don't think it was in Sapiens. I think he wrote a follow up book. But his whole thing was that everyone and everything is an algorithm, and that the future is that we're just going to, like, we're going to have utopia because we're going to understand this algorithmic nature of everything. And he was saying it in like an optimistic way. But what's interesting is the things that he's assuming there and the things he's leaving out. And yeah, I think that's more of a reflection of the technological society he's embedded in, that people are more and more starting to turn that into a kind of metaphysical conception of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I can say, like, this is all backwards facing. When you use these types of algorithms, sort of statistical prediction, machine intelligences, they have to look at some sort of past phenomena and then use that to extrapolate what they think is going to happen in the future. Same thing with all of your media entertainment. It looks at how a past product did and then wants to do a variation on that. Mm-hmm. So it becomes like just a complete dead end. Like, you can't actually do progress in the true sense of the word anymore, because we have decided that the sort of empirical instrumental reason is the only way forward. We have to infer everything by doing studies.
This is also reflected in the faith people have in AI, and this belief that I think is really naive, that we're going to invent AI that's like self-aware, or it ends up with the transhumanism stuff. But it comes from this idea that everyone thinks that the human mind is a computer, and there was a philosopher, Dreyfus, that wrote against AI in the 70s, and all his predictions turned out to be correct. But he was arguing against these materialist types that thought they were going to have like a perfect AI in the next 2 decades. And basically his central contention against them was that these people, the scientists in the MIT, in MIT, the science department, have a completely faulty understanding of the human mind. And that's why they'll never be able to replicate it, because they think that the human mind is a computer, and like the mind as a computer it's been used as kind of a useful analogy, but it has become the kind of accepted belief, and people do see the brain and the mind as this kind of a reductive material thing that can be completely predicted in this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we can start to wrap it up here. With obviously everyone should read, it's a short read, everyone should read Capitalist Realism. It reminds me a lot of of Guy Debord's The Society of the Spectacle, in how much a short work can have a very tremendous impact in being able to condense these very real issues and explain them in a way that can come across to, that can be easily understood. Although I think Debord can be a little bit harder to read sometimes than The Society of Spectacle can be a little bit harder to read sometimes in the language than Fisher is. But definitely read Fisher's Capitalist Realism. But I guess where I want to kind of end with this, because this is especially for people who have never encountered this stuff before, I guess where I would want to leave this conversation off as, like, okay, we've delivered all this philosophical information, and we've basically told you how everything is fake and gay. We've put you in this position. Like, what do we tell people now at this point? Like, how do you live with this knowledge? Like, is reflection the way forward? Is just constantly educating yourself? Like, what do you do in Capitalist Realism? I guess is the question that we have to leave people on. And I don't know if you guys have any answers to that.
Well, thinking about one of the biggest problems being the temporality, the changes to our perceptions of time, I think you have to start learning to construct, at least in your own life, a meta narrative for yourself. And there's some sort of psychological term for this. I forget what it is, but basically, like, a way to contextualize your own life and, for lack of a better term, your own personal destiny. And once you start doing that, you're probably going to feel a little bit more sane, and then you might be able to start to make sense of things and think of real alternatives to the current paradigm. Because I really think that what they have done to our sense of... Oh, did I slip over Keith?
Yeah, I'd echo McNabb. I think it's important, really, just to lessen your needs as much as possible. Because I think there's a whole myriad of ways we don't realize how much we're embedded in the system until you can be somewhat self-reliant from it. And I think I'd have a similar conclusion about where dissident thought needs to go, and that we need to start conceptualizing a kind of post-growth or post-industrial political formation, that isn't just, you know, we'll become China, we'll adopt state capitalism, we'll build huge manufacturing and we'll get industrial civilization roaring again, and you know, everyone will have a very comfortable lifestyle, and then we'll fix all the social problems. I think we definitely need to think more radically, especially because it's a space that the left is kind of more and more abandoning, and the left is becoming more and more irrelevant. I definitely think there's a space there for more radical ideas, like Zizek says, you know, that there's a it's time to dream a little dangerously. I think it's how he describes it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're right about the power vacuum in the left too. I was thinking about this last night, is that Zero Books sort of does content that's kind of similar to what we're doing, and I actually listen to their channel quite a bit, but they have a very small following. They're just a very tiny little island in the left, and the rest of the left, if they encountered some content like what we're doing now, they would just focus on the fact that well, we're racist, or we're anti-Semitic, or something, like some kind of ism.
Yep. I'm gonna echo all of that. I don't have anything else to add myself. For people wondering what's the future of the show, what's going to be next, I don't quite know yet. I know Nikkei wants to come on for stuff. He's got a lot of thoughts about a number of different subjects. I know DK, Dharma King, is going to want to come on as well. He'll probably want to do a quantum physics episode with me. And of course, McNabb and Keith are always welcome back. If you guys have any particular books or topics or particular people you want to get into for a future episode, I don't know when the next one will be, but this is going to be an ongoing show, because I think it's very important to discuss these things, put these ideas out there, and contextualize, teach people them, because I mean, if we don't teach ourselves, I mean, nobody else is going to. But I've belabored this point. This was a fantastic conversation. Did you guys want to do any plugs or have anything new you wanted to mention before we head out?
I would recommend reading Postscript on Societies of Control by Deleuze. It fits into this work, and it's pretty short. It's very, very short.
Yeah, another book I enjoy is kind of similar to this. Is there's a collection of Zizek essays called Welcome to the Desert of the Real. most of them are wrote after 9/11, so they maybe seem outdated and parrots, but there's some really, really good insights in that. It's kind of similar to capitalist realism. And yeah, obviously, just plug my channel, Keith Woods, and I'd say most of your audience is familiar now.
Oh yeah, no, and we'll definitely have you back on again. What I would also, I guess, like, on just final thing on in terms of, like, what can we do? I would recommend I've been reading Marshall McLuhan's Understanding Media and Ivan Illich's Limits to Medicine. Actually, you'd find that book interesting, McNabb. And it's...
I almost think I was going to order it at one point. Yeah, no, I would probably love that.
No, you'll get it. It's an interesting book. Yeah, he was Jewish himself, but he also converted to... Ivan Illich is an interesting figure, and there's a lot of insights in the book, but it's about kind of like grounding yourself back. This is all about kind of grounding yourself back into what, especially like as we move deeper into hyper-reality, like you need to have some sense of a reality no matter how lost that becomes. But again, I'm not going to belabor this point. Frank, send us back into the desert of the real, please.